The NFL League Championship in 1958 has been credited with changing professional football forever. The New York Giants played the Baltimore Colts in a game broadcast on TV to millions, and its legacy has been a half century of football fever ever since. As a player, Frank Gifford played a role in that contest, a major role, and he celebrates it in his new book, The Glory Game, published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased it has brought him here today. Welcome. So what was it about that particular game that makes it so memorable?
I think the timing as much as anything, Lenny. It was a time there of change, really. It was going on in, I don't want to sound like a politician, I guess, but things were happening.
Well, there are many different times of change. This is another one.
Games were being televised nationally for the first time, being broadcast on radio nationally. It was time for it to grow. It had a tremendous following in New York City, yet the press didn't cover it. There were no football writers to speak of. Now there are scores of them, but it wasn't being covered. And this particular game came right at a good time, and it was the first sudden-death game ever played, and that went into overtime, and that also took it nationally out on the West Coast in primetime hours.
Now, why wasn't the press covering it? College football had a very large following at the time. I would have assumed that the college, the reporters who covered college would then just go on to cover the pro game as well.
Except it didn't happen that way. I started playing for the Giants in 1952. I played in front of crowds of 8,000 or 9,000 people at the old Polo Grounds. It wasn't until 1956 that we started to sell out a Yankee Stadium. And, of course, 1958, this NFL championship game was not even a sellout. Today, you can't buy a Giants ticket.
In fact, in the early days, a game wouldn't be televised. There was an agreement, wasn't there, if it hadn't been sold out. So a fan at home would suddenly discover that the game wasn't on TV that day. That's not likely today, even in the weakest of the markets.
That was part of the television contract at the time because the owners and the commissioner at the time, Bert Bell, was afraid of the monster called television, maybe rightfully so at some degrees.
Well, it probably worked the other way, don't you think? TV really made pro football.
It really did.
Did anybody have a sense of the importance of this game on that day, do you think?
I don't think so. In fact, I know so. We certainly didn't.
You just thought you were playing a game.
Well, I was more concerned about, getting home and getting packed and moving back to California. And most of the other players were in the same kind of mode as I was. It was the last game of the season. We had to play a playoff game with Cleveland to get into that game. And Baltimore had a week off. And so we were a very tired football team. It was the last game of the season. Our kids and our wives were home packed, and we were getting ready to go to the different parts of the country where we all came from.
My guest is Frank Gifford, who with Peter Richmond has written The Glory Game, How the 1958 NFL Championship Changed Football Forever, published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You played the Cleveland Browns for the game to get you into the championship game. Was Jim Brown still playing with the Browns?
Jim Brown was in his second year, I believe. And
so that was a potent team with Otto Graham at quarterback.
They were a great football team. There's no question about that. And we actually had to beat them three times that year to get in to the championship game against Baltimore. We played them during the course of the season. We had a very strong success against the Cleveland Browns and Jim Brown, primarily because of our defensive coach, Tom Landry, and our middle linebacker, Sam Huff. And Sam, of course, was always very proud of the fact that we were able to shut down Jim Brown. He's one of the great running backs of all time. In my estimation, the greatest football player of all time.
I think he averaged 5 yards a carry or something like that over his career. It was
incredible.
Quite extraordinary.
But I think he gained 13 yards in that playoff game that we had to win to get in the game against Baltimore.
Although that's also an indication of how football has changed. In those days, African-Americans were mostly running backs. Nowadays, and there would never a black quarterback or a black linebacker because that was obviously a reflection of racial attitudes. Now that's
Well, the
no
racial attitude
case.
Is not in pro football, but in at the collegiate level. Most of the Southern schools, there was no integration whatsoever. You look at the great teams now in Alabama, Tulane, LSU. They have mostly black players. At that time, they had none. And the NFL was only as good as the players they drafted from the colleges.
From the top colleges.
And we actually had quite a few black players at the time, and two of them all pro, and one of them in the Hall of Fame. Rosie Brown, one a dear friend of mine, went into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and then, of course, Roosevelt Grier, one of the great defensive players.
So the trick was to draft players named Roosevelt, and you did
very well.
Didn't
work that way. The New Deal.
On top of the fact that you say that the press really didn't take pro football seriously, the New York newspapers were on strike at the time of this game, weren't they?
So it didn't matter whether they covered it or not. One of the people I interviewed for the book was David Anderson, who was a sports writer, retired now for the New York Times, but later became an award-winning sports writer for the Times. But he was at the game because he just went to the game. But they weren't publishing because they were on strike. There was a newspaper strike here in New York at the time. So that was one of the other things that we probably would have mitigated against it becoming a memorable game, is the fact that nobody covered it.
So why did it become memorable? Why did so many millions of people watch this game when they hadn't been watching games
in
the past?
It went into overtime.
Yeah, but they didn't know that it was going to go into overtime until it went into overtime.
At the time, television being in its infancy, more people would turn the television sets on in the evening. And consequently, as we went into the evening hours, we picked up a lot of viewers that probably never had watched a football game.
And then they saw just how exciting this thing was.
And they saw people, they weren't memorable at the time, but that's the other thing I think that it made it kind of a legendary, is the sense that some of the players that they watched that day and heard that day were players like Johnny Unitas, Sam Huff, Lenny Moore, Frank Gifford, Rosie Brown, Rosie Grier.
Charlie Connolly.
You had endless numbers. And I think there was a total of 11 that went into the NFL Hall of Fame, and all of them played in that game.
Now, you were playing in Yankee Stadium, as you said, and I detect a certain disdain when you talk about baseball, comparing it to football. Why?
You seem to
suggest that football is superior. Here you are in the same locker room that one of the most successful sports franchise worked out of every day during the summer. And you were a raggle-taggle team at that point.
Well, I resented the way pro football was viewed from the time I came into it, which was early in 1952. And we were at the Polo Grounds at the time, and actually the Maras, who owned the team, almost went bankrupt in 1953. They were in the coal business, and coal business was disappearing. Gas was coming into mode. Pro football hadn't taken off, and they almost lost the football team. That's how far it was, how far down it was when I came into it. But I watched it grow, and there was no resentment against baseball. I was offended a little bit by the fact, and maybe more in retrospect as I look back, no one bothered. The press in New York didn't even bother covering pro football. They didn't have, like I said, there were no football writers covering that game.
And even if they had, that was what they did in the off season.
That was a throwaway.
They didn't know the game particularly well. Nowadays, we are subjected on a typical Sunday to the kind of analysis that I think in the past even athletes weren't given.
Oh, it drives me crazy. It really does, Lenny.
Well, you were part of the process that led to that. You and Pat Summerall and some others, who the former athletes who wound up giving us the insights into how coaches and players thought.
I actually was doing a nightly radio show the year I was playing that game in 1958, and filling in for Phil Rizzuto, who had a radio show, and it ultimately led to my going into broadcasting and, of course, into a career. It involved Monday Night Football for 27 years of bringing football on a Monday night.
And when you were doing that, you weren't doing the kind of analysis we get now where they're going to tell us that this is a blitzing situation.
No. Of course, maybe it's because we didn't know.
Really?
And I suspect that most of these people, in not analyzing the game for you now, they don't know either. But it sounds good. If you make it complicated enough, John Madden is a beauty. I love John. And I watch him, and he's got that coachese. And I played the game a lot of years. I covered it for, like I said, 34 years. It's really not that complicated. It really isn't.
Well, in those days, you didn't go over the films the way you do now, did you?
Oh, I did. I looked at 16-millimeter film, and, of course, now they look at it on tape. I used to go up to the league office and look at the films, the game footage that the coaches used and the officials used of the two teams we had coming up. I went out there and I'd spend sometimes 2 days a week.
So
I mean, we all did that.
So you were analyzing it, but there was a big difference, as you point out. People smoked in the locker room.
Oh,
I can't imagine that happening today.
No.
And they drank beer in the locker room?
Sure, absolutely. Valentine was the beer of choice that day, and we'd get a case of Valentine's every week. We had one of our sponsors, and that was really stepping up for us.
Were they concerned about health, or was this something that people didn't even connect to health issues?
I think if you go back, we're talking 50 years ago, and cigarettes were everywhere, and they were in commercials, and movie stars were smoking them in movies. It's only a natural thing. I mean, athletes smoke also.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really know. We weren't privy to the hazard of smoking.
And when offensive linemen had beer bellies in those days, they were really beer bellies.
I guess you could say that. What would you say about today?
Now they're guys who just haven't, they're not in perfect shape. You tracked down all the players on both teams, at least the ones that are living. Was that
living
difficult?
Well, it started out, if I can go back and give you a little bit of history, David Halberstam was a friend of mine, and we both had homes in Nantucket. And David was working on a book called The Coldest Winter, and it was about the book about Korea. And I was fascinated by, number one, him, and also the book he was working on. And I got a strange phone call one day, and he wanted to take a break from it. He was so intense, and I'm sure you knew him.
And he loved sports.
Yes, he did. But he also, when he got involved in something, he totally immersed himself. I was more curious about what he was doing as he was making the final edit on that book. And he wanted to do something that was unusual. He wanted to do a book on Bill Belichick. So I thought, well, that'd be unusual, knowing Bill is a good friend of mine. And so I called Bill. They got together, and they did the book. And then I got another call. And he said, you know, it's the 50th anniversary of the 58 championship game. He said, I'd like to do something on that. He said, you think we could find some of the players? And I said, yeah, I'll do that for you. And that's what I did. I had pretty much all of the players lined up and talked with them. It was fascinating.
Did you just Google them?
I found them in different parts of the country. I called the PR director of the Giants. I got other people involved in it. Then I found like a Bob Schnelker who played in that game. He knew where Dick Modjeleski lived. Modjeleski knew where Cliff Livingston, I couldn't find him for the longest time, a linebacker on our team. But I had all of them pretty much lined up for him. And then David had gone out to speak at Berkeley in California, was going over to see Y.A. Tittle, a Giant who came along later. He wanted to talk to Y.A. And he called me and asked me if I'd call Y.A. for him, which I did. And Y.A. said, well, I can talk to him this afternoon. I called David back. He was driving over to see Y.A. Tittle. There was a driver that he had from the University of California, ran a stop sign apparently, or a truck did, and of course David was killed in that accident, and that was a little bit devastating to me myself. But later on I thought, well, I'll just go ahead and finish this, and that's what I did. And a couple of other books have been written about it. There'll be more articles because this is the 50th anniversary. But I think this is unusual in the sense that not only was I a player, but I talked to every living player who was around that remembers that game.
And when we come back, we'll find out whether they remember the game the same way that you do. Mm-hmm. Frank Gifford has written with Peter Richmond, The Glory Game, How the 1958 NFL Championship Changed Football Forever. It's published by Harper. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Frank Gifford. His book, The Glory Game, How the 1958 NFL Championship Changed Football Forever, is published by Harper. So you spoke to all of the different players, and did they have pretty much the same sense of that game that you did?
The first thing I did, along with Peter Richmond, I went back to NFL Films, and I got the actual footage of the game. And I went back and looked at it myself, and then I looked at it again. And again and again, I kind of got caught up in it. And some of the things that I didn't remember that took place, like the game was stopped late in the fourth quarter because a television wire had broken or something like that. And there was no transmission going out, so the network, the Dumont network, sent somebody running out onto the field to grab the football to stop the game.
And so it was broadcast on Channel 5 here in New York.
And then across the country by Dumont. But it was a lot of things I've discovered that Baltimore, from a technical point of view, they were a 4-3 defensive team, but they were over-shifting it to what we had called our power plays, our 47 power, 49 sweep. And not to get too technical, but I was surprised we didn't pick up on that during the game. And then I also was amazed at how quick some of these players were even then. Artie Donovan and Big Daddy Lipscomb, Gino Marchetti, all these great players. But we only 35 players on each team, so we didn't have short yardage defense. We didn't have a short yardage offense. The 11 players who came out there, they played on first down, second, and third.
And when you started, you played both ways, didn't you? You played both on offense and defense.
I played both, yes, in the early 50s. We just ran out of enough players, and so they put me back in on defense. And actually, I started as a defensive player, and then I went to the offense, and then a couple of players got hurt, and I went back in and played both ways.
Don't you wish that?
Not very well, but I did.
But today, you know, now you probably wouldn't even be in for every down.
They also have a 54-man roster now. We had 35, so there are nearly 20 more players on each roster.
But it's amazing how many of those names are memorable. And, of course, the quarterback for the Colts was Johnny Unitas, one of the greatest quarterbacks that ever lived.
And Raymond Barry, the receiver, just as famous for those of us who know the game.
And their coach was Weeb Ewbank, mm-hmm. who not only was great with Baltimore, but later beat Baltimore when he was the coach of the Jets.
Exactly.
Now, why do you think he is not better remembered? I mean, when they talk about the great coaches of the past, his name doesn't immediately come up the way Vince Lombardi.
It's kind of in the book, though, because I talk about Artie Donovan, and who the way they talk about Weeb Ewbank, Lenny Moore remembering that he was kind of a character, and he would scream and rant and rave and do things in a very unorthodox way that I don't think the media understood what media was involved in the game at the time, and he wasn't the most personable sort of a coach, and you sort of had to lobby for that kind of fame in those days. But you know, that's a question that's come up many times. Why isn't Weeb remembered like Lombardi?
Or Don Shula.
Or Don Shula, or exactly, who would follow him. And I think probably it was his personality, because so much of it was personality in those days.
You say he also didn't have much of a sense of humor. And that
well, that's how Lenny Moore remembers him. And Artie Donovan, who, of course, was the source of much of my lore of the old Baltimore Colts, and actually became a really good friend of mine as I was researching for the Baltimore Colt team and connecting up with some of the older players.
Now, you're not suggesting that the Giants coach, Jim Lee, was a great coach, are you?
Not at all.
You didn't respect him much?
No, I didn't respect him much as a football coach, and I think that was rightfully so. It was a personal incident that I write about in the book that I resented, and it wasn't a question so much as respect. I just didn't care for the man.
But you say that Vince Lombardi was the man who...
Vince Lombardi he was a great coach, and we recognized very early on. Of course, we weren't wrong, because when he went to Green Bay, he proved what an unbelievable man he was.
For the Giants?
He was the offensive coordinator. He ran the offense completely. Jim Lee Howell, the head coach, as I point out in the book, didn't do any coaching to speak of at all. He basically was a former drill sergeant, and he acted like one. Tom Landry was in charge of the defense, and if you just look at the two who went on to Hall of Fame careers as coaches, when Tom went to the Dallas Cowboys to win the Super Bowl there, and Vince went up to win, I think, four of them at Green Bay.
But you also suggest that he changed over the years.
He changed in terms of the other players that I used to talk to after he went to Green Bay and left the Giants. I went into broadcasting. He never changed for me, because I broadcast the first Super Bowl game, and nobody could get him to do anything. But I had a scoop in the sense that he agreed to go on with me right before the game, right before the kickoff. And I saw him during the week. I had dinner with he and Marie, and he hadn't changed at all. But I think he changed the persona when he became the head coach. he felt he had to be maybe more stern, more gruff, or whatever it might be.
Because you say he listened to the players when he was with the Giants.
Absolutely.
And you get the feeling later he said, do as I say.
They listened to him.
My guest is Frank Gifford, who's written about the 1958 NFL championship game that he says changed football forever. The book is called The Glory Game. It's published by Harper. In a game that in which you didn't always perform as well as you might have.
Well, you're being kind. It was not far from my game.
Was it because it was a championship game, or was it just
I made a couple of terrible mistakes. I fumbled twice in the game, and actually there were five fumbles in the game. I fumbled twice, but mine were critical in the sense one of them, we were coming out from deep in our own territory, and I fumbled the ball, and they recovered. Baltimore recovered, and they went in and scored a touchdown. I also fumbled once when we were going in for what could have been the score on our part, and so that probably took away at least 3 points from us. So probably had I not fumbled those two times, you and I wouldn't be talking about the game, because I think we would have totally have dominated them. I basically gave them one touchdown and took another away from us.
Now, why would you have dominated them? They had a great quarterback. They had we mentioned some of the players on that team. They were all quite wonderful. And on top of it all, you make a point that Carol Rosenblum, the owner of the team, did all sorts of things to give his players incentives that were now, I guess, are commonplace, but were really rare in those days.
Well, Carroll was way ahead of the scheme, if you will.
He was the new kind of owner. The old ones like Wellington Mara and George Halas, they're the guys who kind of started a team. And
well, they were football people, and from the ground up. And Carroll wasn't. Carroll was he was in a beer distributorship and a very successful one. He was he bought it, and he was a toy and a plaything for him, but he enjoyed it, loved it. And a lot of people say he bet a lot of money on it, whether he did or not, I don't know, and no one ever convinced me that he did. And they talk about the winning touchdown they could have won with a field goal, and they decided to go for the touchdown, and consequently they covered the point spread. That's all hearsay and nonsense as far as I'm concerned, because I would have done the same thing he did. What Weeb Eubank decided to do, and that is go for the touchdown on third down. Had it been fourth down, who knows? I think they would have kicked the field goal.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of speculation as to Carroll's interest in football. Of course, later he would sell the team and pick up the franchise out in Los Angeles, and became he liked exposure.
Well, he would send some of his players to attend kids' birthday parties.
Oh, he was more than generous to his players. I think he was as much as an owner, he was a fan. He really was a huge fan of Johnny Unitas's.
But do you think it's also because he was in Baltimore, a smaller market? Although, as you describe it, New York was almost a smaller market in some ways. I remember talking to some of the former Brooklyn Dodgers who discussed carpooling on the way to the game, and if they'd see a fan they recognized, they'd say,
yeah,
hop into the car, and they take him to Ebbets Field.
You
were all living in the Bronx in what sounds like a dorm situation.
It's still there. It's I think it's a welfare house now, and it was the Concourse Plaza Hotel. It was a pretty ritzy place when we lived there, and
it sounds kind of chaotic.
Three quarters of the team lived there. Well, they were with their wives and their kids, and the kids would go to practice, and the wives would take the kids to the park to play, and it was communal living. But we would on good nights when we could afford it, and we'd get in the D train and come downtown. We'd go to Toot Shores. We'd stop off to usually trade our tickets for the game to some theatrical broker for tickets to Broadway shows, and that's how we lived.
Because you weren't making very much money.
No, it was not. None of us were playing it really for the money. We played because it was an opportunity to come to New York. It was a chance to carry on with the game we all loved. For money, no. Not at all.
And you say an opportunity to come to New York. There are athletes who hate the idea of coming to New York. You were not one of them?
No, I actually, it's when I think back of it, and when I was playing, we really enjoyed New York for what it was. I mean, it was Broadway was big at the time. Midtown was big, and the places we went to, we really enjoyed. A trip to the Village was that. A trip to the Village was something very special for us. I think most of the players today, they can't go out in public if they have any sort of fame. And they don't. And of course, the drivers can always park the limousines for them. And but most of them live in New Jersey, they play for the Giants. And I would imagine most of the Jet players live on Long Island.
Well, a couple of the players lived in Manhattan. They were making the major commitment, I guess. But I was surprised when I read in this book that the Giants spent their time in the locker room before this big game voting championship shares right before the game. I would have thought that that would have been a bad time because you rely on another player to watch your back. And if he knows that you voted against giving him a full share, he might
it
not
It didn't
be
seem so. To work that way, Lenny. Oddly enough, people don't even realize that actually, this was a carryover, a debate that we had from the Friday before when we couldn't decide how many shares we were going to vote. But amounted to, they don't do that today. But in those days, they had to determine how much the gate was going to be and how much of that would go to the players, and consequently, how much of a pool the players would have, how many thousands of dollars they would have to split among how many shares. The 35 players, everyone, that was the only rule. Every active player received one full share. Now that share could be anywhere from $2,500 to $3,000, and that we estimated that's what it would be. There was one player, Jack Kemp, who would later go on to be a congressman, Jack Kemp, who had played and was active with the Giants during the course of the season, had played in a couple of games. It was a friend of mine from California, and I knew Joanne, and I knew how they were struggling, and he was on what we call the taxi squad for the championship game. Did not suit up, but he was the he caused the battle between several of us, and I was speaking for the offensive team, and I said, Jack deserves a share. Sam and several of the other players agreed that he did not deserve a share. Ultimately, we were screaming and shouting right before the game, and Jack got his share.
Well, he should have just allowed the market to decide, as he has suggested. Since it was interesting that Charlie Connolly was not the starting quarterback, even though he was the star quarterback of the Giants.
Well, he was a star quarterback, but he had not started any of the other games leading up to that either. It was some sort of stupid policy that they had at the time. I'd say stupid. I thought it was. In retrospect, I think I was right, because Charlie Connolly was one of the great quarterbacks to ever play the game. Don Heinrich was a really good guy and an All-American quarterback from Washington, but he really, the pro league was over his head. But Jim Lee Howe, for some reason, decided to start him in every game, and he would say, well, Charlie can look it over for a while before we send him in. And we did nothing until Charlie came into the game. And it seemed like a dumb thing to do, but we continued to do it.
Well, the first half was sloppy. Both teams didn't seem to want to win the game.
Like I said, it has been – I didn't call it the greatest game ever played. Other people called it that.
Yeah, but you have to wonder why. Was it the pressure, or was it just
– Well, it
– I mean, all these great players.
No, it was just just one of those
missed field goals.
It was just sloppy. We had everything. They did as many bad things as we did. But the second half got very intense. And then, of course, Johnny Unitas had one of the great games of all time. Ray Berry had 12 receptions. Johnny Unitas had a tremendous, memorable day, maybe the most of his star-studded career.
After the game, you got a letter from Vice President Richard Nixon.
I have a whole series of letters from Vice President Nixon.
He was a fan of yours.
And later, the president.
And he just told you that he's not supposed to take sides, but he thought you played great.
His wife, Pat, went to USC.
And you quit early in your career because of concussion?
I did not quit because of the concussion. In 1960, towards the end of the season, it was my ninth season, and I had a concussion that was rather severe, and I stayed out a year, came back and played three more, and went to the Pro Bowl in another position.
Frank Gifford will be signing books on Thursday the 13th at 1 p.m. at Borders store at 100 Broadway and Pine. He'll also be giving a talk and signing books in Huntington this Saturday at 7 o'clock at the Book Review. The Glory Game is his book, published by Harper. Thank you so much.
Lenny, thank you.